want to share something that I really loved you wrote in the publication, and it says, by remaining open to the idea that many animals have rich emotional lives, even if we are wrong in some cases, little truly is lost. By closing the door on the possibility that many animals have rich emotional lives, even if they are very different from our own or from those animals with whom we are most familiar, we will lose great opportunities to learn about the lives of animals with whom we share this wondrous planet.
Gosh, I wrote that?
Wow. Bravo, Mark.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Purple Stars podcast. I'm Sarah, your host. And as you probably can hear in my voice, I am beyond thrilled about today's guest. He's a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado. He has published more than 30 books and has won so many awards for his outstanding research on animal behavior, animal emotions, compassionate conservation, and animal protection. And furthermore, he is a co-chair of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute and is a former Guggenheim Fellow. Please welcome Dr. Mark Bickoff.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me, Sarah. It's very kind of you.
Mark, before we dive into the question, I'm wondering, while I was reading like the short intro, which is obviously just a tiny, tiny part of what you have been doing or what you are doing, how does it feel to get this kind of intro and knowing, wow, I've accomplished all of that?
It depends on the day. but that's a good question. You know, I love what I do. And so I don't do it for the, I don't know how to put it, for the end goal of any kind of self-aggrandizement. I just love what I do. And, you know, if good stuff comes out of it, which I hope it does, because I'm working for non-human animals and our beautiful and somewhat wounded planet, then I'm happy about that. I never have considered my job to be work. Maybe that's all part of it. Although I do work pretty hard, but I also play and rest very hard.
I find it very admirable what you just said. And I think it's one of the biggest gifts we can give to ourselves, to allow ourselves to be part of a path that we enjoy, where at whatever age we don't consider it as work, where we are happy, where we're not waiting for the weekend and are dreading Mondays, and where we're waiting for the vacation. And I had a guest on the show. She said something very beautiful once. She said, you know, Sarah, it's about mission over metrics. And I think in that case, that's 100% it. And that actually brings me to my very first question. Can you please take us back to a moment where your heart whispered the message that exploring the life of animals and becoming their voice and fighting for what they deserve would be your life's mission?
A moment.
Can be multiple moments, as many as you would like to share.
So when I was very young, I was born in Brooklyn, New York. A lot of concrete, not a lot of nature, although more nature than there is there now. And I don't know what it is, but I used to just talk to all the animals in the neighborhood. And my parents allowed me to do it, although some of their neighbors thought I was fairly wacky. And over the years, when I talked to my folks about those situations, they said I always minded animals, which meant that I cared about them. I could feel their feelings, their joy and their sadness and their grieving. And I was attributing minds to them. And so I actually wrote a book that came out in 2002 called Minding Animals. And the title came from talking to my parents. So I can't, it's hard to play, you know, put a time on it. It just felt natural to do. I, I, it's, you know, some people will say, what do you mean? And I don't know what I mean. I mean, I know what I felt, and that's what is important. I just thought these other animals, I never really thought of them as other animals. I could just feel their joy. I could feel their sorrow. I could feel their presence. And so it was just a succession of many moments, and I was allowed to do it by my folks, although sometimes they told me later on they thought I was kind of wacky, but I wasn't doing anything bad.
I was just about to ask if what the contribution was from your parents' side, because I know that, you know, some parents have a very rigid view of what their kids should be doing with their life. Were they also big animal lovers, or how, like, what made you fall, like, or was it just something that happened to be your path?
Well, we didn't have any animals. My mother was bitten by a dog when she was fairly young, so it wasn't that she hated dogs, she just was afraid of them. But my mother was really a total empath. And of course, you know, as a young boy and teenager, I sometimes probably violated her empathic ways. but I apologized to her later in life. but yeah, I mean, she really was. And you know, you don't know that at the time. You know, you're a kid, you're growing up, and, you know, I didn't know what the word empath or empathy meant at that time. So my mother was very important in that aspect of life, and of my growing up. And my father was just the most positive person I've ever met. But once again, he sustained that positivity for as long as he was alive. So it was a pretty good combination of being allowed to do what I wanted to do. I think they would have preferred that I became a quote, real doctor, not a PhD. but they never stopped me from doing what I really wanted to do. And I did spend 2 years in an MD-PhD program, and I basically disliked every millisecond of it. So when I decided to just leave it, I left it. And they never really tried to stop me.
If we could ask your mom what her thoughts are on your path right now, looking back, what do you think she would say?
Well, we talked about it until she passed away. She was very proud of me. She learned from me a lot about non-human animals, animal behavior, and you know, animal emotions. We used to talk about it a lot. So I think she would say that. I think she would say she succeeded.
I mean, okay. I'm pretty sure about that too. She succeeded in a really big way.
No, I mean, I appreciate your question, because I was really close to my folks. And after going through all the trials and tribulations of, you know, being rebellious and the things young boys do, we've had a wonderful relationship. We really did. And I'm very pleased about that, because later in life, she became really pretty ill. She really had a total breakdown of physical and cognitive function over a decade. And I loved her with all my heart, and I was there for her. And she knew I was there for her until she really didn't know much about what was going on. But whenever I would visit, she would smile, and it really warmed my heart. So I, somewhere in the recesses of whatever was happening in her brain, I think she had a good feeling. And my dad too. My dad really was somewhat of a rebel in his own way, because years before anybody worked at home, my father worked at home. So Of course, the rumors were he was a drug dealer or had some kind of illicit job, because we had moved to Long Island, so he wasn't commuting every day to New York and driving himself up a wall. But I do remember my friends thought, well, his father doesn't work. He's at home all day. And I went, nope, he works. And he goes to Brooklyn or New York City one day a week. But that really translated into a really good relationship, because I've been a pretty good competitive athlete my whole life, and he was too. So there was never, oh, don't do that because you have to study. I mean, I never studied. I was the worst student in the world, basically, until I got to grad school. I just did not want to be sitting at a desk.
Mark, before we dive deeper into your path, I would like to hold a little bit more space for your parents. One question for your mom, and it's very interesting. So I always like pull some cards before I have an interview with someone. And for some reason, your mom crossed my mind, and I said, I would love to have a card for his mom. And it says, I want to show you, like, it's a beautiful woman actually right by the tree. And it says, I'm choosing to see my challenges as my highest good. So I'm wondering, those 10 years that were really challenging, What do you think it, looking back, taught you about yourself, about resilience, and also about how the physical appearance and the physical condition changes, but the love remains?
Yeah. Well, I think what I learned was how, and a lot of it probably was not so conscious, but how much she had influenced me and how hard at some times in life I fought it, mm-hmm. just because that's what you do when you're a rebellious kid. I mean, I was rebellious not because I was doing nasty things. It was I hated school and I used to cut school all the time and I got caught cutting school. And so she didn't know that, but my dad did. And every now and again, jokingly, he would say, I'm going to tell mom what you did today. but it taught me a lot about resilience. I think it was a combination. Well, I guess it was a combination of my mother really fading away slowly. So there was still a lot of connection and my father's optimism. I mean, my dad used to say things like there's never a bad day. They're all degrees of good. So if you're having a crappy day, just say it's not a particularly good day rather than it's a very bad day. And I actually tell my friends that now. And they, for the most part, and maybe they appreciate that. Mimi, we all have hard days and, you know, life can be very difficult, but and it taught me gratitude. You know, that as my mom was fading away, my dad was just really positive about other aspects of his life, the long-term relationship they had, you know, together, and supporting her. So it's hard to separate out mom from dad, because I think it was a combination, because sometimes I'd be amazed at my father's positivity through very difficult times. When you lose somebody physically and psychologically, mentally, you know, cognitively, emotionally, it's a lot. I mean, you know, and so I think it's that combination. No, and never doubting, I mean, I never really thought about this until maybe 20 years ago, but never doubting that you were loved, mm-hmm. you know, that was really powerful. So for me, I think I'm a pretty resilient guy, but I am 1,000,000%. I have, you know, unbelievable gratitude for the life I've had and the life I have now, but it's not all been roses, you know, mm-hmm. but you got to get through it, you know, and you got to pay attention to to the the vacillations, the ups and ups and the downs. But right now, I mean, everybody's probably got some complaints about the state of the world, and everybody who works with non-human animals has some complaints about the abuse to which they're subjected. You got to get through it. I don't mean that in any kind of prescriptive way, but you got to get through it, and you have to express your love for life. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for giving us an insight into your parents. They sound like wonderful people, and that explains also why you are who you are. And I always find it so beautiful when people are talking about their parents, that their eyes light up and that they share the good things and the traits that they let them continue living inside them. And as mm-hmm. you said, the gratitude, the resilience, the optimism. And what really touched me deeply is when you said, we can't really separate your parents, you know? And I love that, because I think nowadays a lot of people have this picture of relationship that it's, you know, a lot of fighting and there's a lot of separation. And I think it's beautiful when we hear about people that worked as a team. And that doesn't mean that it was always easy, but that they kept choosing each other. And that also, you know, it's about rather than who is right, but how can we move forward together? So I find it very, very beautiful what you just said. And you already mentioned that your path also had a lot of ups and downs. And you are clearly very connected to your calling. And I've seen this with a lot of people, including myself, when being connected to our calling, it often goes hand in hand with a sense of disconnection from others.
Yeah.
And in your pioneer work for animals, how have you experienced that sense of isolation or maybe even other emotional tolls? And how have you navigated through them and maybe even come to the acceptance that these challenges come alongside the rewards of being a champion for animal rights in your case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we don't have a year, so I have to do a little condensing. it's a really good question, Sarah. Some of my friends, I think, over the years have, and I take it positively because I've got some very, very close friends. You know, I think some of them have worried about me, thinking that I'm too much of a recluse. And I am in some ways, but I can be very social on the others, but I rekindle myself more one-on-one or alone. That's where I really energize myself. But I also energize myself by looking around me and seeing other animals and seeing, you know, beautiful flowers and trees and feeling a part of, if you will, their world. It's very energizing to feel that kind of acceptance in the grand scheme of things, if you will. I've lost some very close friends. I think maybe because of my views on non-human animals and, you know, animal protection, animal rights, whatever you want to call it, because they would say, well, you care about more about like my dog Jethro than you do about me. Jethro was the last dog with whom I lived. And I would say, no, I never cash it out that way. I don't cash it out in terms of amount, like, you know, $5 is half the amount of $10, or mm-hmm. my attraction to another person or my interactions with them is two times or two times more or two times less than it is to a dog or a cat or a bird flying by my window or a beautiful flower or what, you know, whatever, whoever. But I find that working with non-human animals and working with animal protection, like I have, and trying to protect the planet, it's exhausting physically and emotionally. And that's, and sometimes I just really rekindle, if you will, in isolation. Mm-hmm. But I do think that I've lost some friendships, relationships, because of that. Because everybody has a finite amount of energy and time. And I, like what I said before, was another kind of bumper sticker from my father in terms of working hard, playing hard, and resting hard. And I still do that. And the rest is really important. You got to fill the gas tank in order to get out there. And sometimes, you know, and I'm sure you've experienced this too. And I don't really know you, but I think I might know more about you than I give myself credit for. You rekindle alone or with very few others with whom you feel comfortable by just being your wacky self. It's hard, you know. I haven't lived with a dog in a while because I moved down to Boulder. We had some big floods here 11 years ago, and my house in the mountains was fine, but the roads were washed out, and I have a beautiful place in Boulder with a beautiful view. So I started staying down here. So my best friends, if you will, in the non-human animal world, although I have a lot of dogs and cats in my life, are 37 stuffed animals. And I talk to them. And sometimes people just, they don't say a word, but that they leave. My younger sister knows exactly what I mean, because I've got a sloth family.
That's so cute.
And I've got a sloth, his father or mother, I can't really assign any gender to them. But in a serious sense, I energize myself and thrive in quiet. Or another aspect of my life that my really good friends know is that when I stop working, I stop working. And if I'm going to watch a movie or read a book, I don't watch heavy movies. You know, I just don't. You know, people think that I watch a movie, so if I fall asleep and miss 10 minutes, I haven't missed a thing, although I do like Humphrey Bogart movies. or if I read a book, I can read every other page and not lose the flow. But I do mean that in a serious way, because I do put out a lot of energy. I know I do, physically and emotionally. And sometimes I just get to the point where I talk to myself and say, slow down. And mm-hmm. I mean, a good example, you know, for just now is somebody just invited me for dinner and I would love to have done it. And I said, no, you know, I'd love to see you maybe in another time. But I did a long bike ride this morning and it's not like I'm so physically exhausted, but I need my time. Mm-hmm. And some people think that's egocentric, and it's not at all. It's just how I rekindle. Does that make sense to you?
100%. I totally feel you.
Yeah.
And you would totally be my kind of friend. Because first of all, I found it interesting what you said, that you have lost a lot of friends along the way. I probably wouldn't consider it as loss. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think, what is friendship or any kind of relationship? It's having a certain understanding and honoring of the needs. And I do think you seem to be a very respectful person. And if you are communicating that, you know, you're putting a lot of emotions out there, and it also, even if you do it with all your heart and your soul, it is like energy that's needed emotionally, mentally, spiritually, physically. And I think if people cannot understand that or actually celebrate that, that you are so true to yourself, then I do think it's great that life eliminated them and made space for those who can understand you mm-hmm. at your core. And I think when you, what you said to your friend, you know, like I did the long bicycle ride and I would love to do it another day, is not selfish at all. I actually mm-hmm. think it's one of the biggest ways of saying I love you to a friend, because you are saying, right now, I cannot give you the love and the attention that you are worthy of in that moment. Let's do it another day. So I personally think it's all about a mindset, and you're setting a real example for a lot of people to be a good friend. And if some people might have a different definition of friendships, then you're just not a match.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, because you've said it exactly what I feel, but you said it much more coherently than I
But I totally feel you. And I'm also a person, I'm very social and I love to meet people, but equally, and if not more, I need my me time.
Yeah.
I need the time to spend in nature. I need silence. I need introspection. I need time with God and my prayers, just to recharge my batteries and also to process everything that I have experienced and to, you know, let go of certain energies. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's not selfish, it's self-love, and it's necessary in order for us to be connected to our calling, to ourselves, and also then to be of service.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's very well put. And I think that I don't like to, I mean, with really close friends, you can do it, you know, just sort of be halfway there, if you will. They know you and you know them. And but in certain situations, if I can't be there, you know, Boulder's like the land of crystals and flowers and feathers.
I've been there and I loved it.
Oh, okay. Well, you'll have to come back then.
Absolutely.
No, I actually feel that if I can't be there in the, and you know, different people have different expectations, different needs. If you can't be there in the way that someone wants you to be there, it's best for them not to be there, if you mm-hmm. will.
Very true.
And I think I try to be present, and you can't, you know, you can't be present all the time. You know, you just can't. And getting back to what I really do, you know, daily working for non-human animals and animal protection, and, you know, as well as the well-being of the planet, it takes a lot of energy. You know, you spend a lot of time you don't realize trying to figure out how to help an individual animal or a particular problem out there. And you don't realize how exhausting it can be until someone says, let's go get a beer. And you go, oh my God, I would love to spend time with you. I just don't have the energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes friends will coax me and I go and I'm really glad, you know, but I have a fairly good monitor on myself of when I can be there in a certain way. And I don't want to hurt other people's feelings. Because that's draining as well, mm-hmm. to know that you're not there in the way that they would like you to be there. And they have a right to have their likes and, you know, expectations. So I don't really beat it to death. I actually just listen to myself. I mean, it's like with food. I just, you know, I don't plan meals. I just, I'm a great microwaver. I like good food, but I don't sit around and think all day of, you know, what I'm going to have for breakfast, lunch, or supper. Mm-hmm. I just find something and stuff. But I do tap into what I feel within me. Mm-hmm. And somebody not too long ago, it was an animal issue at hand, and I made a comment like that, and they said, I think they meant it in a derisive way, but I took it in a praiseworthy way. They said, "You're very feminine." And I went, "God, that's the nicest thing anybody's told me this week." I actually really did. I actually liked it. but I don't think that they were saying it in a way that was meant to be praiseworthy.
Well, I recently talked to someone and we talked about intuition. Mm-hmm. And that person says that he thinks intuition is a very female trait. So I personally think someone saying you have, you know, it's a very female way of doing it. I personally think it is a compliment because female, as you said, it's about nourishing. It's about giving. It's about intuition. It's about rest also and receiving. So I think we just take it however we like to take it, whatever. It doesn't matter how how they meant it. And when we talk about feelings, I want to talk about one of your books that I have here, which is The Emotional Lives of Animals.
Oh, the second edition you have there.
Yes, it's very nice, right? I hope next time I come to Boulder, I hope you can like sign it for me.
It would be my pleasure. You have to buy me dinner. I'll sign it. No, I'm always kidding.
I love how you do this trade. Sounds good. And Mark, so there has been a lot of disagreement when it comes to the emotional life of animals. Can you share how your views have challenged the traditional views? And also, before you give me your answers to that in the publication, and it says, by remaining open to the idea that many animals have rich emotional lives, even if we are wrong in some cases, little truly is lost. By closing the door on the possibility that many animals have rich emotional lives, even if they are very different from our own or from those animals with whom we are most familiar, we will lose great opportunities to learn about the lives of animals with whom we share this wondrous planet.
Gosh, I wrote that? Wow. Bravo, Mark. No. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that stems from the way I grew up, just freely expressing what I was feeling. Other animals were saying, you know, really feeling it in my heart, in my cells, feeling the really deep connection there. But to me, I love doing the science I've done and still do. But science is about curiosity and learning about the world. And so over the years of studying animal emotion, some aspects of animal cognition, you know, things that I was feeling and knew that would be, I knew they would be discovered, if you will. You know, people got on me. You know, I think in the foreword to the first book, and I believe in the foreword to the second book, Jane Goodall, who wrote it, my good friend Jane Goodall, said that I've been, if you will, quote, fighting the establishment for a really long time, because I had no doubt that animals had deep feelings. And the whole history of sort of the study of animal emotions was it was perfectly okay to attribute negative emotions to animals. You know, they're fearful, they're angry, they're mad, they're violent, they're vicious. But if you said they were happy or sad, or embarrassed or jealous or grieving or mourning the loss of another individual, you know, people would say you're anthropomorphic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know what anthropomorphism means, but after a few years of teaching, I just said, we don't use that word anymore. There's just, it's usually meant to open the door to animal abuse. There's a great quote in here from Brian May, the guitar player for rock group Queen, about anthropomorphism, you know, and what it does is we say, well, Sarah's feeling this way or not. Oh, you're being, you know, Sarah morphic or Mark morphic, and therefore you could do anything you want to them. So, so that took a while, but I refused over the years you know, Jane's been a great mentor to me too. And before I ever met her, when she studied the chimpanzees in Gombe in the early mid to late 60s, you know, she named the animals and she attributed individual personalities to them. And when she went back to University of Cambridge, the people there said, well, we don't do that. We don't name animals. We don't talk about personalities. And I mean, I don't know what her response was other than she continued doing it and laid the groundwork for people like me and others to name animals and to talk about individual personalities and feelings and emotions. But it also struck me really early on, and one of the reasons I left this PhD MD program was that it was just wrong to intentionally harm animals for human ends. Okay. You could say it's wrong to intentionally harm dogs or cats for the betterment of other dogs and cats. And it is. But every time I would express that, people would get very upset and they'd say, oh, you're anthropomorphic. Oh, you're just too touchy feely, blah, 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 blah. I never felt that way. And I think that was the legacy of my minding animals when I was 2 and 3 and 4 years old on the concrete streets of Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. But I know there was another question there, you know, that you had, and I don't remember it other than, you know, I was just following my feelings and following my heart. And my parents accepted that. You know, they were not happy that I dropped out of this MD PhD program. They would have preferred me to keep on, but I didn't want to do it anymore. So it wasn't like, oh, bad mark. You know what I mean? It was like, mm-hmm. All right, we'd like you to do this, but you can go do that. But it's following dreams somehow, following your heart and following your dreams. And oftentimes I think that becomes apparent retrospectively. You know, I don't sit around thinking about the last X number of years, but I do. And, you know, you've asked some autobiographical questions and others have asked me recently some autobiographical questions. So for me, the road from being 2 years old to where I am now was very nonlinear on the one hand, but the constant factor was that I was allowed to follow my dreams and my heart because my parents didn't try to channel me. I mean, they would express their desires, but I could, you know, just say no and mm-hmm. and move on. So, yeah, sorry, yeah.
I probably, the question that you were relating to was what advice you would give to someone who feels called, same mm-hmm, as you, mm-hmm. to challenge the status quo, because mm-hmm. you were very lucky that you had a background from your, you know, like your parents had your back. But there are some people that are not as fortunate. And that's, I think, a big factor why sometimes people are holding themselves back to go for what they actually want. Plus, mm-hmm. a lot of people are very afraid of the backlashes that can come from society. Yeah. And as it was in your case, from the, you know, traditional views. So what advice would you have for someone who feels this really big heart tug, but is battling between a heart tug and the fear?
Do it and be nice to people. You know, it could be parents, it could be friends, lovers, spouses, whoever. Be nice to them, but don't let go of that draw that you have. Mm-hmm. Don't let go of it. I mean, it's going to come around at some point. It's like, if you don't deal with something happening at a given moment, you know, oftentimes it's a grieving moment, but it could be a loving, romantic, positive moment, then don't think it's just going to disappear. you know, it's going to come back and bite you in the behind, as counselors and psychologists will say. But if you feel this draw, it might not be obvious at some points. And there were some points when it was internal. I was probably fighting to manifest it externally, but the current situation didn't allow it. So when the doors opened, I mean, for me to follow my heart, follow my dreams, follow what I really was passionate about, I snatched that opportunity immediately. And another one of my father's saying, all my grandparents were Russian immigrants. So my parents were first generation USers, Americans. But another one was sort of, when opportunity knocks, get off your butt and answer the door. And, you know, these things, you know, when my parents would say that to me early on, I'd go, oh, they're so square, oh, whatever. I'm not saying everything that they said was prescient, but it's true. You know, a lot of what they said or did and modeled was very important for me. But it just comes back to feelings. Mm-hmm. It felt right to do what I was doing at the time. I wasn't being nasty. And, you know, as a young academic, you can pay the price when you step outside the bounds of academia. You know, so when I started studying play behavior I studied it in wild coyotes and foxes and domestic dogs. And I said, they really enjoy it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, some people said, well, what do you mean they enjoy it? And I know my first response, I'm not anti-academic, but I'm tired of all the academic BS about having to write 40 pages on what animal joy is. I said, they seek it out. I don't tend not to seek things out that are going to be aversive. Mm-hmm. If they're firing with all eights in their brains, they seek it out, they get tired, and they seek it out again and again and again, and they seek out playing with their friends. Oh, what do you mean? Animals don't have friends. I mean, this is true in the history of animal behavior and ethology. I said, of course. I mean, they seek out certain individuals. They relax in their presence. They share food. They play. They may rest next to one another and spoon one another. I mean, what do you mean they don't have friends? Mm-hmm. Then I realized some of the people saying that animals didn't have friends were people who probably did not have many friends themselves, because they were so fill in the blank. But I kept with it because I really believed. I believed that we would be where we are now with a lot of hard work, with a lot of hard work.
I'm very, very, very glad, and so are millions of people and animals around the world, that you kept following that heart tark and kept going against the grain and having the courage and also finding a way of, as you said earlier, you know, like connecting with people and also drawing back into like solitude in order to hear that heart talk even louder and have all these visions and bring it down to paper and raising the awareness around the world. And can we talk more, please, about the range of emotions? And I particularly would love to talk about romantic love. Mm-hmm. And you shared in your book a very touching tale about Annie and Charlie, and it's in the chapter of Love is Blind. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I was like, wow, this is just so good, and I want this to be on the podcast.
You know, research has shown that, you know, if I want to lapse into the scientific sphere, I mean, non-human animals have the same range of emotions that we have. There's joy, happiness, elation, sadness, grief, mourning, embarrassment, guilt. I mean, you know, you name it. And, you know, Charles Darwin wrote a lot about these emotions, you know, a good 150 or 100, well, I guess it would be 170 years ago. And a side note is, I think more and more people, and researchers included, are much more open to these sorts of discussions now. So I always say it's not a matter of if different emotions or feelings have evolved, it's why they have evolved. Because I'm really a biologist, and, you know, the why they have evolved is really the question of what are they good for? You know, what is my anger to you or somebody mean? What does my love to you or something like that mean? Okay, and why is it still there? Okay, so romantic love and love in general, close relationships and romantic love. I mean, I never could understand why people would question that, it's especially given the history of saying that animals can hate one another and they can be nasty and violent and vicious and aggressive and fill in the blank with all the negative emotions. So I actually never understood that, but I remember writing something years ago about, could have been two dogs I was living with, but I don't remember the exact animals, saying, well, they love one another. They seek one another out. They show a preference for that other individual over the presence of other individuals. They rest near them. They miss them when they're gone. I mean, I was always at a loss. I remember once asking a colleague, well, what do you mean they don't romantically love one another? I didn't get it. I mean, and then when I was doing field work in coyotes and I've studied other animals, including penguins in Antarctica, I mean, there's individuals who love one another. I can't think of a better word. You know, I mean, you could think of synonyms, but, you know, that's it. You know, I mean, it's just a feeling you have. You know, if you've lived with other animals, it could be dogs, cats, guinea pigs, you know, whoever. Just notice how they respond in the presence of some animals rather than others. It doesn't mean they hate the other individuals, but there's a strong positive attraction there. You know, they don't necessarily walk down the street holding hands. I suppose they could walk arm in arm if they were bipedal. So, that's my take. And then, of course, there's been a lot of research on, I call it the big O, oxytocin. You know, so I think a lot of the research on oxytocin has been overblown. I mean, they call it the love hormone, the attachment hormone. Well, maybe it is, but I'm not a mechanist that way. Do I enjoy reading about studies like non-invasive research or some of the MRI work being done on dog and other brains? I do, but I don't need that. I mean, once again, and I always felt in the field, especially, well, maybe not only in the field, go to dog parks, that there were special connections between, say, two dogs or two cats or a guinea pig, you know, or a ferret or a gerbil, I mean, a lovely mouse or a rat. And you could feel their attraction to one another. And I know people say that borders on the spiritual and it borders on the non-scientific, and who gives a damn? Mm-hmm. it borders on your feelings, you know.
Mark, what do you think is one of the many reasons why some people are so longing for explanation and proof for things that they see? Because I'm very much like you. I also read a lot of research and everything when it comes to my field. But when I feel something, my thought is not like, oh, what could explain this? Where's the research? Like, I'm just like grateful for having that feeling. And if that's what I feel, then that's what it is. And yeah, so that's why I'm wondering what, because you have come across so many of these kind of people. And I'm sure you've spent a lot of time also thinking why they are like that. So I'm wondering what is one of the reasons why people are so longing, or that kind of people are longing for certainty and answers and proof?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is science worship. And I don't mean that in a negative way. You know, people want proof. Mm-hmm. You know, they want precise measures of something, a hormone, when you're talking about different sorts of emotions, for example. I think part of it, too, is the worship of science without paying attention to, say, their own feelings. You know, I think the emotions of other animals are really contagious. Mm-hmm. You know, and it doesn't have to be the animals with whom you're the most familiar, like dogs or cats, in my case, you know, or coyotes or even penguins. But they just need the numbers. And, you know, that gets into another aspect that another criticism of the field, Sarah, was, you know, anecdotes. You know, they're just stories. You know, they're just so stories. Well, you know, if you have another 100 anecdotes about the same thing, you've got a pretty good database. So Dale Jamieson, a philosopher with whom I've worked a lot, we say the plural of anecdote is data. And then, you know, and then somebody got onto it and just started beating that to death and coming, when I say after us, just tweeting and doing all these things that, no, the plural of anecdote isn't data. And then I got an email, do you want to respond? And I went, no, and stuff. I mean, but the point is, you know, when you're in the field, you don't see things like you might see in the dog around your home or your cat around the house or an animal in a cage. So if you see something happening 30, 40 times in wild coyotes or penguins or wolves or birds I studied around Boulder, then there's something going on there. Mm-hmm. So the other criticism is that a lot of the observations are, quote, uncontrolled. But you can make the same criticism of controlled laboratory work where you have a very controlled situation and the animals don't have they don't have the freedom to do what they're supposed to do to demonstrate they have a certain emotion or feeling, you know. But, you know, I studied dogs a lot, and I had a student study feral dogs. I've studied free-ranging dogs. I go to dog parks a lot. And people will say dogs don't feel guilt, or they don't do this, or they can't do that. And I'm thinking, I just saw this 100 times this mm-hmm. morning at a dog park where they're running free. So it's not so much a criticism of the science. I actually wrote a lot about that in a book called Dogs Demystified that came out last year, saying it's not the science that's bad. It's just you're studying animals who just don't have the freedom to do what they need to do to, say, demonstrate a particular feeling or a particular emotion. You know, it could be putting a person in a cage or in an aquarium with nothing around. And you'll say, well, they don't do this. Well, they can't do it because they're not free enough to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think that the argument, you know, getting back to your question, why do people look for the science? And then they criticize uncontrolled science is they don't criticize over-controlled science. I mean, imagine trying to learn something about you, but you don't have the possibility of expressing either a cognitive capacity or an emotional feeling. And I go, well, Sarah doesn't feel that. She can't. Or Sarah can't do that math. That she can't figure out how to put these sticks together to do something. Well, it's because she can't put the goddamn sticks together. I mean, so I think that's it. But I think that's softening now, in the sense that people are really realizing that we need to study animals when they are free to perform species, typical species specific behaviors. So throwing them in a bear cage or getting dogs to choose an object that's under a can or not under a can, they're all interesting studies and the science is good, but I don't know what they tell you about the real life of a dog or the life of a real dog.
I love what you said, that we need to give them the freedom to be who they are. I'm now rephrasing it in my own word. And I'm also so happy. I think like one of the many things that I love about you is you're building the bridge between the seen and the unseen. And I think that what makes life whole too. And I think it's important to hold space for both of it and to build the bridge. And I see it a little bit as like yin and yang, day and night. It's the same with medicine. And that's why I prefer not saying alternative medicine, but complementary medicine, to say, okay,
yes,
it goes hand in hand. And rather than saying what's better and what's worse, let's make the most of both of the worlds and like get that like full range for it. And that's why I'm so happy to have you on the podcast, because you're just like that person that says, you know what, just because I don't have that research on it doesn't mean what I just saw didn't happen. And I think it's so important.
No, the seen and the, I love the way you started out. I just remember something, the seen and the unseen. Right. I mean, I think part of my views also come from having spent countless hours looking at film
also
of animals. What's that?
Also countless animals.
Countless animals, but watching a countless, you know, frame by frame analysis, watching a slight turn of the head, rotation of the eyes, flicking of the ears and the tails. Really to the point where some of my students said, I just can't do this anymore. but when we were in the field studying coyotes and studying penguins in Antarctica, you know, you've got to pay attention to subtleties. You know, you've got to pay attention to what they're doing. And that sometimes makes people feel uncomfortable. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, thank goodness, but, you know, they think you're actually looking and analyzing them. No, I'm not. But you train your eye to see what I was playing off of, Sarah, because you said it so eloquently, was to see the unseen, to hear the unheard, to smell the unodor, you know what I mean? That, you know, and stuff like that, because that's how non-humans are communicating, very subtly sometimes, just a, I can't do it, but, you know, a slight movement of an eye, a slight opening of their, of the mouth, a slight movement. I mean, ever so slight movement of the ears or the tail or the hair on the back going up. We call that piloerection. And that's what I get paid to do, and I love doing it. But I don't necessarily want to do it with other human beings. Do I do it? I might do it subconsciously. Maybe I learn something about another person. Maybe I don't. But ethology is really careful observation. It's really, you know, and then when people would say, well, are you surprised that, you know, a particular dog or coyote or wolf did that? And my response often is no. I mean, I knew they were going to do it. Oh, do you have a spiritual connection with them? And my answer usually is, well, I might, but I was just actually watching them.
Yeah.
I was actually watching their body movements and watching their ears and their tail, really subtle. That really does come from a long history of watching film frame by frame. And one of the studies we did on birds in the foothills here, looking at patterns of head up or head down, head up scanning for predators, head down feeding. And they're pretty mutually exclusive, that you can't have your head down and sense a predator or head up and feed, came from looking at what these birds were doing frame by frame. And we actually learned something that no one else ever knew by doing it. And in addition to myself going moderately crazy and students, at the end of every session, I'd have to take them out for beers or margaritas because they were they were just shot. but seriously, you know it. But you know what the greatest reward is, or among the greatest, is when they just turn around and go, "Wow, look at that!" Mm-hmm. You know, so I'd always say, you know, there's every dark cloud has a silver lining. So yeah, you're bitching and moaning about watching these films, but after a month, you're seeing. And then you know what the cool thing is you begin to see them without having to see the film. You become really a keen observer where we used to play this game, because doing field work can be fun, but it's also pretty hard. And we'd play this game of predicting what a particular bird or coyote would do. And you get pretty damn good at doing it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't come from some fluffy connection. It comes from careful observation. And maybe, I always used to tell them, you know, we're all fluff balls. Maybe it's a little fluffy connection too, but it does come from the careful observation, you know.
And a careful observation, the seed to it, or the roots to it, is the love. The love that you have for it, because that would allows you to sit there hours and hours and hours and decades and decades and decades. And that also builds then the deep connection to it, to the animals. And that's why I guess you then say, oh, I knew that was coming.
My conversation with Mark is just getting started. And if you love this episode, get ready, guys, for part 2 next Wednesday.